Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Earth Science Ontolog session number 3, October 2012, co-chaired by Pascal Hitzler and myself. This is Christoph Jenowitz, and the topic for today is heterogeneity preserving data interoperability methods and challenges, and we have 4 speakers, and before introducing them, I will just give you a very, very brief overview and about what we are talking here and why this is a relevant topic. So if you advance now to the second slide, this slide should be called town or city. You will see some figures. You will see map fragments and pictures. And at the left, you can see, for instance, LA. You can see the map of LA and the city of LA. Clearly, we would call that a city. It's gigantic. On the top, you see in Pennsylvania, Bloomsburg. And then on the right top, you see a place in Utah at the Zion National Park. So what I'm trying to say here is that if you would like to run a query, for instance, a federated query over linked data or another federation of data sources, then before you can do so, you have to make sure that actually you're using the same language in terms of the terms that you use, so in terms of the ontology that you use. And unfortunately, it turns out that in many domains, and especially in interdisciplinary research or the geosciences in general, this is really tricky. So what I'm trying to show you on this slide is that the question whether these places are towns or cities, for instance, in DBpedia, is more difficult to answer than you may expect. In fact, for instance, in California, city and town are declared to be equal by law, while in Utah, so that's the example at the upper right, everything is a town that has a population of less than 1,000 citizens. And in Pennsylvania, for historical reasons, there's just one thing called the town, namely Bloomsburg, and it heavily advertises this status as the only town in Pennsylvania. And you will believe me that each of the states of the U.S. has their own definition of what makes a town. Sometimes they are driven by population counts, sometimes by administrative subdivisions, sometimes by other factors. So what is happening currently, for instance, on the linked data web is that they are all pulled together and named town or city and doesn't do the trick. But I hope at the same time you will agree on me with me seeing that example, that simply coming up with a common definition will not work because these states have their history and their own registration for good reasons and not by chance. So we need to find methods to interoperate but still respect the heterogeneity of local schemata. So if you go to the next slide, that's the slide called What Defines Forests, you will see a very similar scenario, this time with natural kinds. And the question here is, well, what exactly is a forest? Before we had 50 member states, or of course you can play the example with many, many other countries and their definitions. Now we have the question, what defines a forest? And there's a great online paper by a guy called Lund, which currently lists more than 900 definitions, all of them useful, all of them in legal use, used in science, governments, and so forth. And they divide areas that are afforested into different chunks by different criteria, like the minimum area they have to be a forest, the minimum crown cover, tree height, strip width, and so forth and so forth. So a lot of things that count as forests in Greece, for instance, or Switzerland, don't count as forests in, say, the United States or Brazil. And again, the question is, how do you query such data in a way that you keep the data interoperable without trying to force everybody to use the same schemata, because we are convinced that while this may work in some settings, it's most likely not to work in highly interdisciplinary settings. And this is all I'm giving away of the topic for today's session. The rest will be done by our wonderful speakers. You will see their names on the next slide. This is slide 4. It's called today's session. And we will introduce the speakers directly before the presentations. So we'll start with Simon, then here talk by Pratik, then Ben, and then finally by Giancarlo. Each of these talks will be about 12 to 15 minutes, and then we will have a joint discussion at the end for about 30 minutes. So that's everything from my side, except Pascal wants to add something. If I don't hear anything from Pascal or don't get any sign from him, then I'm going to start with Simon Scheider. Simon is our first speaker for today. He is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Münster in Germany, one of the biggest geospatial semantics groups that I know of on Earth. And Simon has also been a postdoc at the University of California, Santa Barbara recently. He also did his PhD at the University of Münster, and before that, he was a researcher at the Fraunhofer Institute at St. Augustine, so he has a background in data-driven views, say, machine learning, and is now heavily moved into the area of geospatial semantics. And Simon will talk about what does it take to integrate semantic interoperability revisited in terms of human digital communication. Simon, it's up to you.
Thank you very much, Jano. As you can see, if you open the slide, my slides, you will see that I'm a member of the Münster Semantic Interoperability Lab called MUSIL. So you might expect that I shouldn't have something to say about interoperability, and indeed I have, actually. What I will try to do in this talk is give some sort of revision propose a revision of this term of semantic interoperability, mainly because I'm pretty much dissatisfied with current notions of semantic interoperability. The reason being that in current paradigms of semantic interoperability, in my view, in my opinion, certain pragmatic aspects are missing. And these pragmatic aspects are my focus of the talk. So and I will actually discuss or introduce these aspects by two examples in the next two slides. So if you go to the first slide, this example is taken from a paper from 1999, one of the earliest papers actually of on semantic interoperability in the geospatial domain. And these authors, what they did is they looked at a sports ground near Münster, near the town where I'm from, or where the institute is, where I work. And what they did is they took a look at this sports ground several kinds of maps. One of them is a cadastral map, another one is a topographic map. You see them on the right-hand side of the slide. And you also see that in the cadastral map, the track and the soccer field are missing, whereas in the topographic map, the track area is visible, which is the white area in the aerial photograph on the left, and the parking lots as objects are also missing. And if you think about, or if you know what a cadastral map and a topographic map is, then there's a pretty straightforward explanation for this. And a cadastral map is a map of land parcels, right? So it's about land ownership primarily. And the distinction between the soccer field and its surrounding sports ground is not one of ownership, right? So this distinction does not appear in this cadastral map. And similarly, in a topographic map, the surface feature of this, or the track area, is distinguished by its surface and therefore distinguishable in the topographic map because it's a map of the ground surface features. But the soccer field and the parking lots are social objects. They're conventionally delineated, right? And that's why they don't appear in this map. So what I want to say with this is basically, depending on a certain view on reality, we come up with not only different categories, but also different inventories of objects. And this has a very practical relevance because if you look at on the left-hand side, in the slide, there's actually this sports ground in Google Maps. And it seems that Google Maps sticks to a cadastral view on the world. So let's move on to the next slide, to slide two. This is the other example. This is about a famous pedestrian shopping area in Frankfurt, which is called the Zeil. You can see it on the left-hand side on this aerial photograph. And there, similarly, there's the question how to represent this pedestrian area. In Google Maps, it's represented as an ordinary vector object with traffic restrictions, actually. So it's a road object, an embedded road graph. In OpenStreetMap, on the right-hand side, there's actually not any corresponding object, not any object that corresponds to the tile. What you can see there is a polygon that somehow depicts a walkable area, city surface or something like that, but it includes many more other places, and not only the tile. So there's no corresponding object there. So let's advance to the next slide, slide 3. So the challenge of interoperability in a nutshell is that the problem cannot be reduced to labeling. And that would be the left-hand side of the slide. You see there a picture of a car. If the world, that's actually what the world would be like if semantic interoperability was just a labeling problem. There you have just an inventory of objects, and the problem is only to agree on certain names for these things. But that's not the problem we are facing. The problem we are facing is that conceptualizations vary considerably. That is, each data set comes with an intrinsic perspective, and for good reasons. To the extent that things and their categories in one perspective do not exist in another one, and sometimes terms may not even be comparable across perspectives. That's illustrated by the cartoon on the right-hand side of this slide, where this young boy asks his father whether this is a meadow, a field, or a vacant lot. You may answer, well, all the three of them, depending on perspective, right? So, if you move on to the next slide, slide 4, what I would like to propose, therefore, is that we need a new paradigm for semantic interoperability. The existing ones could be summarized under the under these headings there, namely holistic standardization, top-level ontology alignment, and pluralist peer-to-peer translation. The first one is the main idea of it is term meaning standardization. The goal is basically to resolve heterogeneity, and the means to reach this goal is to subscribe to a standard, basically. A similar approach stands behind top-level ontology alignment. The pluralist peer-to-peer translation approach is based on similarity in translation, and we'll have two speakers today that will focus on this idea. Of course, don't get me wrong, all of these paradigms are very useful. I'm not arguing against any one of them. I'm rather arguing for two new ones, namely bottom-up construction and human-machine-human communication. The first one, the idea is instead of standardizing, aligning, or translating term meanings, this one focuses on term meaning generation and communication. And the strategy regarding heterogeneity is not to resolve or avoid or mitigate it, but to articulate heterogeneity. The means to do this, so, is the ability to understand semantic differences and to act on these differences. And I call all of these paradigms semantic imitation paradigms, and I hope it will be clear in a minute why I call them like this. So please move on to the next slide, slide 5. So interoperability could be seen not only as a standardization and translation problem, but also as a communication problem. Since sharing meanings, in my view, is basically a result of human communication, so it requires understanding acts of reference. So if you think about a human-machine-human communication system, like the semantic web, for example, you see this in the middle of the slide there. It consists of code, which consists, in the case of semantic web, of URIs and RDF. However, not only of code, also of encoders and decoders. These are humans that encode their actually acts of reference and their domain of experience. And the problem on the side of the decoder is to interpret this code appropriately. The problem is that these acts of reference that are being encoded, they are not part of the code. Okay, reference therefore gets lost since it is generated outside the machine, and So the problem we are facing is that it's not a machine communication problem, but the problem that humans misunderstand each other when communicating via machines. If you go to the next slide, slide 6, this slide contains some theses about how to approach this problem. And they're part of my thesis, basically. So for me, sharing meaning requires, in the first place, to recompute it in terms of shared operations. In this view, meaning is something that observers do, so it's a speech act that joins human attention on some reproducible phenomenon. Similarly, to what Michael Tomasello has proposed in his book from 1999. And sharing meaning, therefore, requires a kind of an imitation, okay? In the sense of, it requires a regeneration of meaning in terms of shared operations, like perceptual, technical, and constructive operations. There's an example on the right-hand side of the slide, on the lower right-hand side. These are two robots. One is an observer robot, another one is a demonstrator robot, and the observer robot needs to imitate a certain gesture. And how is he going to do this? Well, he needs to recompute this gesture in, with respect to his own frame of reference, which is anchored in his body. And this is what I would like to propose is a general approach towards sharing meaning. Okay, let's go to the next slide, slide 7. So, interoperability could be seen as a result of semantic imitation. And or to say it more properly, I think that interoperability is a result of playing a semantic imitation game. So there's in this game, there's a provider and a user. The provider transfers data to the user. The user may not share the necessary semantic categories underlying this data set. And therefore, in this game, what the user does is he tries to imitate the provider by reconstructing data categories. And the task of the provider is then to teach those data categories by examples and rules. And the game, in the end, may be evaluated by precision and recall, for example. This is the basic idea, or the basic suggestion I would like to make. It's still on a very abstract level, so in order to make it more concrete, let's go to the next slide, slide 8. Because in order to make it concrete, we need to talk about tools, right? So do we have semantic imitation tools? And I would say the good news is, yes, we have, because all the tools we already use can be used in this game. We only have to think about the roles, their roles in this imitation game. And this schema here that you see on the eighth slide is a schema of possible roles of tools. So there are synthetic tools, for example, constructive calculi, sets of rules that allow to build construction procedures. These construction procedures produce construction patterns out of primitive concepts, which are slots that can be filled or instantiated by data. And instantiation procedures generate new data by instantiating these patterns. That's the synthetic side. And on the analytic side, we have learning procedures taking data and figuring out possible construction patterns. As you can see, the schema is inspired by logic, but does not have to be applied to logic, so it goes beyond, I would say. And this can be seen by the last two slides. If you go to slide 9, there's an example of a tool or an approach that fits into there. It's taken from a paper by Ben and Jano, which is about mountain categories and definitions of mountain categories as complex regions and conceptual spaces. In this case, the primitive concepts are measurement scales. The constructive calculus is a vector calculus. The construction procedure is, or the construction patterns are convex regions in this conceptual space. Concepts of interest are mountains. An instantiation procedure takes these regions and applies them to actual data, mountain data, like in the bottom of the slide. And there's also a learning procedure available to do the analytic side, right? the analytic problem, namely a cluster procedure, a cluster analysis algorithm. And then please move on to the last slide. This is another example. This example, on slide 10, right, this example is about, not about category construction, but about object construction. So if you want to play these semantic imitation games, an important thing is that we also may need to construct objects because the objects are not there. This is an example taken from my own work on road and junction construction based on graph simplification procedures. In this case, you have the constructive calculus is a graph simplification calculus, and construction patterns are graph patterns and so on. And there's also a learning procedure available, namely delineation procedures for detecting roads in data sets. So that's it, basically. If you move on to the last slide, I say thank you.
So thanks a lot, Simon. And we move on to the next talk, and then we have discussion session at the end, as usual for these settings. So it's my pleasure to introduce Prateek Jain. Prateek is a research staff member at IBM T.J. Watson Research Center in New York. And he's actually there for, I believe, a little less than 2 months now, and before that he was a PhD student at the Noesis Center. He was not my PhD student, he was the PhD student of Amit Sheth, but I had the pleasure of working with him. And I believe one of his main challenges in the last few weeks of his PhD time was to navigate all the excellent job offers he got from prominent companies, and so he made the absolutely best pick there and went to IBM. Rather than telling you about a number of publications and other accolades he has received, let me just a little very brief personal story. There's always a pivotal moment when you do a PhD thesis, and we probably approach that when we're trying to solve some problem where we needed to do some alignment of linked data sets, just as a small part of the work. And as a supervisor, I just said, well, there are so many ontology alignment systems out there. Just take them from the shelf and use them for solving it, and then keep going with the work you're doing. That's what Prateek tried. Turned out they all essentially miserably failed for our task. And then he came to me and said, I have an idea how to do that and how to do it better, this alignment of linked data. And I looked at his approach, which he presented to me briefly, and I said, I don't think that's going to work. But if you think it works, then by all means try it, because we all have to try ourselves. And that's what he did, and a couple of weeks later he came back to me and actually had improved the performance on linked data alignment for in comparison to all the other state-of-the-art systems by basically something like doubling precision and recall. So that was the breakthrough moment for his PhD thesis, and I'm extremely proud that I had the pleasure of working with him. So, Prateek, it's over to you. Looking forward to your talk.
Thank you, Pascal, for the introduction. I mean, the pleasure was all mine. You actually made my grad school really, really good. But anyways, moving forward to the talk, this work which I'm going to present, it was actually, like Pascal mentioned, it was a joint work with him and some of the other colleagues from the lab, and it was basically tailored towards aligning linked open data ontologies after noticing some of the drawbacks in the existing data sets. So the talk is related to that. So most of the people over here, I would imagine, are familiar with the linked open data cloud. 2006, Sir Tim Berners-Lee gave the four principles, basically using URIs as names for things and HTTP URIs for identifying things and so on. When you click on that URI, the person should be able to access more information and all that. All of us are familiar with it. It led to one of the major milestones in semantic web, the linked open data cloud, and everybody started calling it the mainstream semantic web. Even nowadays, if you look in the blogs related to semantic web on Planet IDF or any of those places, everybody still keeps saying it's the mainstream semantic web and all that. And it's no doubt it's a great achievement, but definitely there are certain issues which stick out. Slide number 3. one question when you look at the linked open data cloud is that there is definitely a lack of the relationships, which are very, very important whenever we are talking about semantics or data interoperability. Is like, how is the data or the entities related to each other? Another important question, something which has helped database community a lot, is the ways in which they have allowed data to be queried very easily, something with which we are still struggling, and although we have Sparkle, but Sparkle has its own set of limitations, and definitely when it comes to linked open data cloud, there is still no fixed answer as to how to go about querying these data sets, in which are so distributed, so heterogeneous, using Sparkle queries in a seamless fashion. Then something which is of interest to a very particular community in the semantic web is the idea of how do you go about reasoning linked open data, schema level reasoning over the linked open data cloud. And it's important because unless you can do the reasoning and you're able to figure out new assertions and new things, I'm not sure if it fulfills the entire vision of semantic web, which was given to the people a while ago. To give you an example of the kind of data heterogeneity and the kind of data modeling issues which linked open data is suffering from, move on to slide 4, where we are talking about geonames. So geonames has this really rich dictionary or really rich collection of places and the different kinds of features which they possess. And they use different phrases to represent that certain place is a populated place versus certain place is abandoned populated places and so on. If you look at it closely, and if you have even a reasonable knowledge related to semantic web technologies, or even object-oriented programming for that matter, it's very easy to figure out that there is actually an implicit relationship which is present between all these different so-called features. I mean, you would imagine that a destroyed populated place would probably be a subclass or subfeature of populated place. But geonames does not represent it. And I'm not picking specifically even geonames, because even if you go and check any other data set, the story is still the same. There are certain data sets which are really notorious, I would say, when it comes to the issue of modeling. For example, we were trying to do one of the queries using the U.S. government GovTrack data set. And when we ended up figuring out how the data was modeled, it was one of the most convoluted examples I have seen with respect to data modeling. It was an example related to how the senators were voting with respect to the healthcare legislation. Moving on to the next slide. Like I mentioned earlier, linked open data is really cool. It's an extremely important step if we want to make semantic web mainstream and being used in industry and all that. And it's something which I'm really happy about, is the fact that I'm actually exploring ways over here to utilize some of the data sets for actual industrial application and being able to reason over them and all that. But one issue which still sticks out and I still continue to face at my work is that, like I pointed before, if the data sets remain semantics free and they do not represent and model the relationships properly, then it will be of very, very limited value. Moving on to the next slide. Most of the relationships which are present in the linked open data cloud, as you all know, are at the level of instances. Almost pretty much all the entities which are present over there are connected at the by using the all same as relationship. It's a matter of debate whether even that same as relationship is correct or not, but I do not address that question in this particular talk. There is a very strict lack of relationships such as superclass, subclass, equivalence relationship between these classes, and some of these relationships are extremely important when it comes to identifying relationship between entities. One of the things which I've been working with over here is being able to identify what are the different occupations of people, so especially when it comes to named entities. and this is a problem which I'm actually dealing right now, is there is very limited or no notion where I can actually identify the fact that a musician is a type of an artist, and they are not disconnected entities at all. And there is no such relationship like that present in the linked open data cloud. People who are familiar with this community might say that, hey, why don't you use one of the ontology matching tools and try to figure out how these entities are connected to each other. And before this work was started, that was actually the thing which we started exploring, is to use some of the state-of-the-art ontology matching tools and see how well they do or how well they did not do. And our idea was that even if they do not perform with 100% precision and recall, which is unrealistic, still we wanted to at least see results which a human can curate and identify and work with. Task of ontology matching, moving on to slide 8, is very straightforward. Basically, what you have is two different entities. You have a matching algorithm which utilizes, which may or may not utilize auxiliary information, and it will give you the matching results, which are essentially in the form of these two entities are related by, have this specific relationship with each other. And this specific relationship could be equivalence, could be subclass, or could be superclass. Moving on to slide 9, most of the existing schema matching approaches which you come across in the literature, they are two different kinds of these approaches. One is the individual matchers, where you take one technique and you stick with that, and then there is another one where you basically combine different matchers to produce better results. These individual matchers, again, are at the level of schema-based, where you're considering only the schema-level elements, and the other one is the instance-level or the content-based. Although this diagram is actually taken from a paper related to the databases community, but it's still very applicable even for semantic web or ontologies. The schema levels further bifurcate into different categories like element level, structure level, where you take into account things like using linguistics information such as dictionaries, name similarities, and all that. Then you also take into account constraints like you can say that a person who plays a musical instrument but does not sing is somebody who is only an instrumental artist, and so on and so forth. So there are all these different approaches, and most of the existing state-of-the-art matchers which we came across and which we saw were utilizing one of these techniques. In certain cases, they even use advanced computing techniques like machine learning or even data mining-based patterns and all that. But still, they're very well covered under this specific tree. Moving on to the next slide, when we started utilizing these techniques on the linked open data schemas, we came across some very interesting results. And these are not results which are made up. These are actual results where we saw nation was equated to menstruation with a pretty high confidence levels. And when we started identifying what might be the reason, we came across that the LOD ontologies which were created by community are of very different nature. They have been created by community for community. And then a very heavy emphasis with respect to LODs on instances and not on meaningful relationship. And they definitely require a solution which is beyond just pure syntax matching and just using dictionaries and so on. So our approach was to utilize the knowledge which was contributed by users in the web in different forms to improve the knowledge contributed by users in a structured form. More specifically, the slide related to ontology matching on LOD using Wikipedia, we were trying to utilize the Wikipedia categorization or the Wikipedia hierarchy system for the purpose of ontology matching. The Wikipedia category system consists of overlapping trees, and there are some very simple rules for categorization, one of them being transitivity. Then you do not place the pages directly into every single category, but only into the most specific one, and every page has to belong to at least one category to be of decent quality. So the Bloom's approach utilizes the Wikipedia category system by first it preprocesses the input ontologies to remove some of the constraints, tokenize the class names and so on. The next step, it constructs a Bloom's forest for each class using information from Wikipedia. So you look up the name for the concept, you try to identify what are the corresponding category hierarchy trees, and then you try to compare the category hierarchy trees with each other to identify the relationship which is present between them. I'll skip the slide related to Bloom's decision. I'll give an example of the next slide in the Bloom's trees, since I'll be running out of time. So in this particular slide, you have Jazz Festival being aligned with event. And when you construct the Bloom's trees for these two using Wikipedia, you will notice that there are certain nodes which are grayed out, which are common to each other. And in the case of event, those grayed out nodes, which are more generic, happen to be at a much, they are much closer to the concrete node event than they are in case of Jazz Festival. Or in other words, Jazz Festival has to go down a few more levels in order to be generic enough as event. We utilize this information along with the fact that the nodes on the left are more important than the nodes on the right, according to Wikipedia category system. And we were able to formulate a heuristic using which we were able to identify that Jazz Festival is actually a subclass of event. Moving on to next slide. For the purpose of this evaluation, what we did was we identified Bloom's as a tool for LOD ontology matching, as well as a general purpose ontology matching tool by comparing it on some of the existing state-of-the-art benchmarks. In both the cases, to summarize the results, we noticed that Bloom's was at least twice in case of precision and recall, if not at the same level when it comes to precision and recall on linked open data ontology matching systems, as well as the existing state-of-the-art benchmarking tools. Because I'm running out of time, so I'll conclude my talk over here. It's very short, but if in case anybody has more questions, I'll be happy to answer them at the end, or you can just email it to me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much again, Pratik, for the wonderful presentation. Our speaker is Benjamin Adams. So to describe Benjamin's position right now, it's a bit tricky. He just moved to the ENTI Center at the University of Santa Barbara as a researcher, or let's say a postdoc to be. Why do I have to phrase it this way? Simply because Ben is in the very last weeks of finishing his PhD here, but already started a wonderful and very challenging and interesting new job. So currently he's also a PhD student, as I said, at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's doing his PhD at the Geography Department here with us, but in fact Ben's background is in computer science. And even before starting his career in academia, he was working in industry as a software engineer. And what I think is especially interesting about Ben's work is that he combines machine learning, for instance, using unstructured text together with similarity reasoning and analogy reasoning, and puts this all together into a semantic web framework, for instance, to learn about types of geographic features. And Ben will talk briefly today about semantic similarity measurement for geo-ontologies. And now it's up to you, Ben.
All right. Thank you, Jano, for that introduction. Everybody hear me okay? All right. So my name is Ben Adams, and I'm affiliated with the NC Center at UCSB now. To follow up the previous talk, I'll now give a brief overview of semantic similarity measurement for geoontologies, although many of the methods that I'll talk about really are applicable to any kind of ontology. In contrast to the previous talks, I'll be primarily summarizing other works rather than discussing my original research here, but I hope much of the material will be new to this audience. Okay, please move to slide number 2. So in the context of this talk, semantic similarity measurement means measuring the similarity of concepts and instances within one ontology. So this is in contrast to the kind of ontology alignment that was just discussed previously. which tries to match concepts across ontologies. As Yano already discussed in the introduction, many concepts in the geosciences are not canonically defined or in many cases are fuzzy and have different definitions. Therefore, when people utilize systems that are semantically enabled, it's often the case that people will use different but similar concepts and queries with the goal of retrieving the same information. I'll give some more concrete examples in the next slides. In the geo and earth sciences, there's several applications for doing semantic similarity measurement over an ontology. Specific applications include geographic information retrieval systems, semantically enabled gazetteer services, and data discovery, and so on. All right, please move to slide number 3. So in this slide, I'll use an example from hydrology to illustrate what we mean by semantic similarity measurement. So imagine we have an ontology with several concepts from hydrology. We might have canal, lake, and offshore platform. We also have several property restrictions defining these concepts, such as being body of water. There would be might be geometry properties, such as being linear or point features. There may be man-made, naturally occurring, and so on. So for each of these concepts, we can talk about how one or more are similar. And so in this example, canals and lakes are both bodies of water, but only canals are man-made. And likewise, canals and offshore platforms are similar with respect to being man-made, but an offshore platform is not a body of water. So for each pair of concepts, we can talk about measuring some kind of semantic distance. So that's essentially the inverse of their similarity. Now, immediately upon viewing this example, some of the issues regarding semantic similarity become apparent. So we might ask, similar in what respects? What are the properties that matter? And so this is really the problem of what we call context. And I'll discuss in a few slides later on some more about this issue because it's actually a rather complex issue. All right, please switch to slide number 4. So a little bit more formally, when we think about how we might want to search for semantically similar concepts, we can describe it as a search for target concepts that are similar within some context of discourse. So here we have C sub S is a search concept. In this case, it's canal. We might have a set of target concepts. And we can talk about the context of discourse. The C D is the set of target concepts that are drawn from maybe a larger set of concepts within the whole ontology. So this is one way in which we can talk about context, where we sort of restrict, where it is that we want to look for similar concepts. Now, given these CSs and CTs, the similarity reasoning operation is then a pairwise calculation of similarity between the CS, the canal here, and the various CTs that we're looking at. And then subsequently, you'd often translate the similarity measurement values into some sort of similarity ranking. All right, please switch to slide number 5. So here are some examples of the kinds of similarity queries you might want to do with an ontology. And so many of these are from a paper called The Semantics of Similarity by that Yano and other co-authors, Martin Robel and Werner Kuhn, wrote just last year, where they go into some more detail about these issues. So you might ask, for example, how similar is canal to river? What kind of water body is most similar to canal? What is most similar to water body union with the class of artificial things? What is more similar to canal, a river, a lake? What are the two most similar water body types in the examined ontology, and so on? So that just gives you some examples of the kind of what we want to be doing with similarity measurement. Now, if you switch to slide number 6, before I go into some concrete methods for calculating similarity. I'll discuss some various common methods. I'd like to first discuss a couple of the properties of semantic similarity judgment from more of a cognitive science perspective. So first, as I already mentioned, similarity is context dependent. And I think, I mean, that maybe seems very intuitive, but in fact, you could also see it as it's essentially meaningless to talk about similarity measurement without some context of discourse. Because if you're really creative about it, you can always find some way that one concept is related to another one. Second, and perhaps less intuitive, is the finding that similarity is directional and asymmetric. And so this stems from cognitive science work done over three decades ago by Eamon Tversky and others that found in particular that when people compare concepts, and especially in concepts such as like a subclass to a superclass, they're often judged more similar. So like the subclass compared to the superclass is judged more similar than when the opposite is done. So an example of this is people are more likely to say that a lake is similar to a water body than to say that a water body is similar to a lake. I don't have time to go into all the nuances of this research, but if you're interested, I would suggest maybe reading the reference paper by Tversky as a good starting point. There are different ways people interpret these kinds of results in the cognitive science literature. Some people view this as, in effect, a context effect, where the context of discourse is different in both cases when you're doing the two different comparisons. From a modeling perspective, the most common mechanism for modeling context is just to introduce weights on various properties. So, for example, in the hydrology example discussed earlier, we might weigh body of water more than man-made, making canal and lake more similar than canal and offshore platform. Now, this is very much application dependent. All right, I guess move now to slide number 7, please. From modeling perspective, finding the most appropriate context weights can be a difficult problem. There are some methods we might use to automatically determine in what ways a property is diagnostic or not within some context of discourse that we're looking at. And toward this idea, there are two notions that are important to think about, and those are the notions of variability and commonality. And so these also stem from the work by Tversky in the late 70s and early 80s. So the idea was that variability is essentially the notion that if a property is shared by most of the entity classes or concepts being examined, then it has low variability and hence less relevance in terms of differentiating concepts. And commonality is essentially the opposite, and that is the idea that when you choose some domain of application, that implicitly states which properties are relevant. This could be done by sort of examining which properties are prevalent within the context of discourse that you're looking at versus those outside. And then, of course, there is the idea that you could get these context weights provided by a user in some application setting. I mean, this could be either explicit, although this is often very difficult for a user to do, or maybe implicitly derived through various methods. For example, taking a sample ranking of concept similarity to pretty much induce which properties are important and which ones are not. All right, please switch to slide number 8. So there, from the semantic similarity measurement literature, there's several approaches that have been taken to take an ontology and look at the concepts within it and calculate semantic similarity. I'm just going to focus on a few examples. You can see on this slide there's several approaches. For time, I'm not going to go into all of these different aspects. I think what I'll do is I'll just move on now to slide number 9. So if you look at slide number 9, in this slide, we show the the matching distance similarity measure that was developed by Rodriguez and Eigenhofer around 2004, although parts of it were developed earlier. And they looked at work originally done by Tversky, taking in these notions of variability, commonality, and so on, and tried to come up with a computational model for actually matching the similarity of what they called spatial entity classes. And so and they give examples of spatial entity classes being things like buildings or hospitals and so on. In their model, similarity is just a weighted sum of the similarity of parts. That would be the S of P, functions, that's the S of F, and attributes, which is the S of A, where the weights, the omega values, all sum to one. Each of those individual similarity measures is based on the ratio model originally developed by Tversky, and the ratio model essentially matches features between the two classes and looks at the cardinality of both the set intersection operation and the set difference. So in other words, it looks at both the common and different features of the class in determining the similarity. Rodriguez and Eigenhofer introduced this alpha variable you see here, and that's used to determine the relative importance of different features. It's defined in their model as a distance between classes, and they take the difference between the classes and the least upper bound, that's the LUB, which is the immediate common superclass of both classes being matched. And so when they look at, when we talk about distance in this model, they're using what we call a network distance, or essentially the shortest path between the classes. But they, when they calculate that shortest path, they not only look in terms of the subsumption hierarchy, but they also look along part-whole relations as well. So there's a lot more to this work, but I'm going to move on now on the next slide to the slide number 10, to the SIMDL framework. So the MDSM was not formulated for the more standard description logic representation, but in order to facilitate similarity measurement for DL ontologies, SIMDL was developed by Christoph Janowicz, but also collaborating with many other people over the years. And so in this model, before I go into the details of the model, one important point to make about doing semantic similarity measurements that are based on sort of this idea of looking at the structural aspects of the ontology, it's important if you're going to do this to translate the ontology into some kind of canonical normal form so that the similarity differences between the concepts do not occur due to syntactic differences. You want them to actually be semantic differences. So the solution to doing that is to then have a series of rewrite rules that will take concepts and write put them into a normal form. In the latest iteration of the SIMDL framework that's called SIMDLA, the difficulty with doing the rewrite rules is that they're computationally expensive, and so SIMDLA reduces that kind of operation into looking at in an inter-instance distance rather than an inter-concept distance. But I don't have time to actually go into all the specific details of this, but we can certainly discuss this in the follow-up session. So the actual measure for SIMDL is essentially this combination of these more specific similarity measures similar to the MDSM. So there's the SIMP measure, which is the similarity of the primitives or the base symbols. So this is essentially like a kind of Jaccard similarity, looking at the two classes. The SIMR measure is a network-based approach that computes the similarity between the roles in a hierarchy. And so in this function that you see here for SIMR, that the LCS function is the lowest common subsumer. The SIMN measure, which is the aspect that specifically tailors SIMDL most to the geospatial temporal realm, is a measure of the conceptual neighborhood distance for topological or temporal relations. And then finally, we have the SIMRF, which is the role-filler similarity, which is a weighted average of role and filler similarities. I'd be happy to go into more detail, and I'm, you know, also Christoph is on this call, so if you have more questions about the details of this, we can discuss this a little bit later. But please switch to slide number 11 now. So the nice thing about the SIMDL framework, very different than many of the other similarity measures that have been developed, is that there's actually a fully functional Protégé plugin available for download. So you see the link on this slide. And it's also, it's not just for geospatial or earth science related ontology. It's functional for any kind of ontology. Okay. Please switch to slide number 12 now. So I've talked about these measures that are based on some kind of feature matching or looking at the graph-based distance measures within the ontology. But sort of a different approach to calculating semantic similarity is to calculate the semantic distance in some kind of multidimensional feature space. So this is sometimes referred to as a conceptual space. So in the spatial model, the dimensions often correspond to ratio or interval scale variables, say in scientific studies. Within the geometric representation, the semantic similarity is a function of some distance in that space. So you can describe instances as points in the space and the concept similarity in various ways. It might be the distance between prototypical instances of that concept, or alternately, you can define the concept as maybe a region or facet along a particular dimension, and then there's different ways of measuring distance between regions. So you might say, for example, the Hausdorff distance to measure the similarity of regions, or you can also interpret these regions in a fuzzy set representation. From the perspective of description logic ontologies, you can essentially think of these geometric semantic similarity approaches as most applicable to concepts that are defined by restrictions on numeric data type properties. All right, please switch to slide 13. I'm just going to give one simple example of what I mean by this geometric representation and how you might do similarity. So in this recent work by Alkvist and Shortridge, they define various land class concepts such as deciduous forest and low intensity residential in terms of ranges along dimensions, these properties of percent tree cover, tree height, and percent deciduous. And so in their work, they happen to have a distance function that's using what they call a dissemblance index, which is just one way of measuring the similarity of fuzzy sets. But this, you could easily substitute other kinds of metric measurements such as the similarity, like an Euclidean distance in space and so on. All right, so I'm going to end it here. There's much more on this work, but in interest of time and fostering the discussion, I've look on slide 14. You can see here series of reference. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Ben. So we move on to the last talk of the session, and then we'll have a question-answering session. Our last speaker is Giancarlo Guizzardi, and I hope I pronounced the name correctly. He can correct us when he starts talking. Giancarlo got his PhD from the University of Twente in the Netherlands and made some stops at the Laboratory for Applied Ontology in Trento, Italy at ISTC. He's currently a professor at the Federal University of Espírito Santo in Vitória, Brazil. Giancarlo is very active in the community, running conferences in different chair positions. He's an editorial board member of several journals, Applied Ontology, Semantic Web Journal, and so on. He's an executive council member of the International Association for Ontologies and Applications and running his lab in Vitória, Brazil, with a lot of very well-recognized output. Now, his expertise, you could say, is quite a lot in conceptual modeling, And this is also what he's going to talk to us about, and I'm looking forward to hearing the talk. Thank you, Giancarlo. It's your stage.
Thank you very much, Pascal. Can you all hear me well?
We can hear you well, yes.
Okay, great. The pronunciation was perfect, by the way. So thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. I'll move right away to slide 2, and I'll focus on one very specific problem, which can be illustrated by this slide. So I have here, so if you have a conceptual model in general, which is supposed to represent a certain portion of reality for communication, for understanding reality, and for problem solving, if we have it represented in a language which is not expressive enough, what we can have is a mismatch between these two sets, which are illustrated on slide 2. So the inner set is the set of intended models, so models, instance of that model that represents intended state of affairs in reality, and the outer circle represents the possible models. So, for example, if I'm talking about, if I'm representing a marriage in a very, very simple model, just saying that the marriage is a relationship between people, I could mean in a kind of implicit, tacit way that this is a relationship between people of whatever combination of sex, but only living people in a monogamic relation. But if I don't constrain enough this model, I will have as possible models, you know, polygamic people, between living and deceased people and so on. So there will be many possible instances of that specification which are not intended ones. So one of the goals of ontology, I'm moving now to slide 3, is exactly to constrain this specification in a way that this ideally these two sets match. So this point was beautifully made by Nicola Guarino in Formal Ontology and Information Systems, the paper, 1998. The idea is that you have a structure of ontology plus a set of constraints, or if you like, if you look at an ontology as a logical specification, you have a logical specification whose set of models in the logical sense are only and exactly those that represent valid acceptable state of affairs in reality according to a certain worldview, right? So if ontology represents a certain conceptualization which is shared by a certain community, the idea is that this ontology should only accept, as instance, things that represent state of affairs deemed acceptable by that community. But now if you look at an ontology simply as a logical theory will allow you to do that, to represent that to a certain degree, but it won't tell you which constraints should be included, which formulae should be included in the specification so that this result can be achieved, right? So this is exactly the point, because if we have, for example, two different agents communicating through a certain model or integrating two different models that represent different perspectives or aspects of a certain domain, if these specifications are not good enough in the sense that I just described, we can have an intersection between the set of possible models without having an intersection between the set of intended models. So this is what is called the false agreement problem. And it's a nightmare for semantic interoperability, right? So we would like to know exactly which is the exact set of constraints that we should include in the specification to have the match between these two sets. So now I'm moving to slide 4, and I will break this problem into parts. So on one side we have axioms or formulae in this specification which are completely domain independent and would be recurrent in different specifications in different domains. So one trivial example is if we talk about parthood, for example. So imagine if I want to axiomatize the notion of essential parthood, so parts that the whole cannot cannot exist without having those things as parts. So imagine a chassis as a essential part of a car. Since in the legal sense, the identity of the car is tied to the identity of the chassis, that particular car cannot exist without having that particular chassis as a part. So I could represent for that particular case of my ontology or conceptual model of car, the exact axiomatization of essential parts words, saying, for example, this is a partial word relation. It has some modal implications. So in every possible world that the car exists, that chassis must be a part of that car. It should also be what is called a weak supplementation, right? So either an object is atomic or it must have at least two disjoint parts and so on. But now if I want to represent another ontology, to represent relation between a relation between a person and the person's brain, assuming that the brain is also, under a certain view, an essential part of people, I would have to reproduce the exact same axiomatization, changing, of course, the predicate, the domain-specific predicates, and so on. So if we can reproduce the exact set of correct axioms for partial relations, which are well understood for many years in neurology, for example, in all these different domain specifications, we can guarantee that at least these two sets are further approximated, like what we can see here in section 4, in slide 4, sorry. So, again, logic will help me to do this formal characterization, but won't tell me which are these domain-independent axioms that should be included in each of these domain-specific specifications. One discipline that can help me with identifying exactly those formally is the discipline of formal ontology in philosophy. So I'm moving now to slide 5. And the very business of formal ontology, since put forth by Edmund Husserl, is exactly to come up with this discipline that would investigate and put forth theories that would verse over formal ontological structures, like theories of parts, theories of classification, theories of wholes, for example, saying what are the relations between the parts that bind them together, forming a unified role, whole, theories of identity, of dependence, historical, existential, generic dependence, theories of causality, and so on. So formal here means formal in the sense of domain independent, and not only mathematical, right? So these theories in formal ontology can give us these micro-theories for each of these sub-areas that we could embed in every domain-specific ontology or model in a way that at least with respect to that perspective, we could approximate those two sets. I'll go deeper in one very, very specific example now regarding a theory of types. So I'm moving to slide 6. So we have here this very well known, actually one of the most supported distinctions in philosophy of language between what is called a kind and a role. So here we have something which is also reflected in ontology engineering approach like ontocline or ontoUML. So the idea of kind here is a type which provides a uniform principle of identity for all its instances of identity, individuation, and persistence. Let's take the stereotypical example of person, right? So every the type person can provide a principle in which we can individuate different instances of person, and we can also judge what kind of change a person can undergo and still be the same individual. In contrast, we have this idea of a role. So, unlike a kind, that every instance of a kind instantiates that kind in every possible situation, so every people, every person is necessarily a person, an instance of role can instantiate that type only contingently, so no student is necessarily a student. All instances of role are all of the same kind. So, for example, all students are people. Right? So, person, role is an example. A student is an example of what is called a sorto. And instances of role are instantiate this role in a certain relational context. So, a student, for you to be a student, you need to be enrolled in an education institution. For you to be a father, you need to have a son. For you to be a husband, you need to have a wife. For you to be a customer, you need to have to buy a product from a certain supplier, for example. Right? So we have these three constraints, among others, characterizing what it means for something to be a role, like student or customer or pet or sponsor, and so on. So if we move now to slide 7, what we can do is to have a certain modeling language in which the modeling primitives of that language reflect the distinctions in this in a formal ontological theory. So, for example, this very simple distinction between kind and role can be reflected in the primitives of the language, and the original axiomatization of this theory can be included as constraints in the metamodel of this language, kind of synthetic constraints in the metamodel of this language. So here in slide 7, we have three models, and these three models would be ungrammatical according to this language. So I cannot have a specification in which I only have a type student saying it is a role. So this thing cannot be directly instantiated, right? Assuming it is a role. Because if the principle of identity is something that we have to use to identify entities in across all possible situations, it must be supplied by a type that the individual instantiates in all possible situations. So it cannot be supplied by an anti-rigid type, which means that the instance of student here would not be viable individuals, right? They could move out of the extension of this class, and we wouldn't have a principle of identity for them. If we move to the second model, this model, we can easily show that it would entail a logical contradiction. So we cannot have an anti-rigid type as a super type of a rigid type. Here, every instance of a student will eventually cease to be an instance of student in a counterfactual situation, but it cannot cease to be an instance of a person. Every person is a student, therefore we have a contradiction. And here in the bottommost model, we have that students are people who are enrolled in zero to many education institutions. This makes sense for database design, but not for conceptual modeling and ontology, because being enrolled in an education institution is the definition of what is to be a student. So here we have a language that, again, its modeling primitives reflect its ontological distinctions, and the metamodel of the language embeds constraints that reflect the axiomatization. I'm moving now to slide 8. So actually, what we have is that because of this constraints governing the relation between these elements, roles can only appear in a model in a very particular way, following a certain pattern, a certain design pattern. Every time a role is appears in a model, like B here, it has to be a subtype in a transitive closure, or a subtype in relation to a kind that will provide its principle of identity, and it has to be connected to a certain relation with an opposite association end with minimum cardinality higher than 1, which describes this relational condition for something to instantiate that role. So we can instantiate this pattern now, like what we have in slide 9, for the case of students. And this pattern, on one side, it becomes a kind of higher granularity modeling primitive. So we are increasing the granularity of the modeling primitives. We are not dealing with classes and relations and attributes anymore, but modeling building blocks. And this will naturally happen when we have a modeling language whose foundations don't have ontological neutrality. Because of the axioms, because of the fact that the axioms postulate the possible ways these things can be combined, they would cluster in specific ways in which they can appear, which is not the case with first-order logic. Because of this ontological neutrality, we can combine things in an innumerous number of ways, including a number of ways that we don't want to combine things, right? So here we have a modeling pattern that embeds a kind of micro theory of what is to be a row. Here is a very, very simplified view of this theory. And it's also, it can be seen from a, now from a logical perspective, that we have a mechanism for theory inclusion. Every time we use this pattern, we are including a number of predefined standardized axioms that follow this theory, this domain-independent theory that we agree on. And also from a, now from a cognitive perspective, having a model constructed in a pattern-based language will also help us to understand the model, because when looking at the model, we are not searching for lower granularity modeling primitives, but we are identifying and isolating cognitively different modeling building blocks. Okay, so this is the part which is related to the domain-independent aspect, right? So we include all axioms from this formal theory in the metamodeling of the language in a way that the language will only accept as grammatically correct models those which are ontologically consistent. This works for the case of this domain-independent axioms. So that we cannot include domain-specific axioms in this language system exactly because they are domain-specific, right? So how to deal with that? So one approach we've been working on is to use the strategy of model simulation so that once the model is constructed, we automatically generate a number of possible instances of that model so that the user can be confronted with what he's specifying in the model. So we move now to slide 10. So this is a very, very simple model for, let's say, a transplant, in which we have a kind, a person, and three different roles, the donor, the donee, and the surgeon. And we have here, let's call it an event, a transplant, an event in which is existentially dependent on both people and organs. Right? So an event can only, this transplant can only exist if there are people playing the three roles and an organ which is not specified here. If we look at this model is perfectly correct from the domain-independent perspective. All roles are connected to a particular kind, they are connected to a relation which satisfies this relation condition, and so on. But still, there are possible instances of these models which are not intended ones. So if we simulate this model, we'll get, for example, the instance we have on slide 11, which perfect, right? So this helps the user, for example, to understand what this model is about, and there is evidence that looking at more automatic model population in the instance level helps people to understand the model in the type level. So here we have an instance of this model with a transplant that has a donor, a donee, and three different surgeons. But another possible model is the one on slide 12. Is a transplant in which the same person is playing the three roles. So the person is donating an organ to herself and performing the transplant. So this is not a desirable model, and it's one that people don't realize it's a possible instance of that schema we saw before.
Giancarlo, just a quick reminder, we're running out of time, so perhaps you can wrap up in two more minutes or so.
Okay. Okay, sorry. It's also the case for slide 13. We have different instances here which are not intended. And in slide 14 is the result. So the first action that people take to try to correct this deviation between these two sets is to say that the three rows are disjoint. Then you run the simulation again, and you see, for example, here that what you did is that the person that is a donor now can never become a surgeon or a donee, which is kind of over-constraining the model, right? Of course, donors can be donated, but not only, but only not in the same transplant. So what we did was to build this platform of doing some simulation. It's a simulation game in which the user runs the simulation and tries to detect cases of over and under constraining. And the last thing I'll say is that in slides, I'll jump to slide 20. What we did recently is to run the simulation in a number of different ontologies in different domains with different sizes and constructed by people with different maturity in ontology engineering. And we managed to find out, to find a number of anti-patterns. So patterns that every time people would use that, they would create this possible deviation between possible and intended models. Yeah, what this slide 20 shows that in some cases we found these patterns, which is called, it's called general cycle, the first one in 100% of these ontologies. In some cases, what's called imprecise abstraction, which is the fourth one in almost 90% of the ontologies. Okay, sorry for the mismanagement of time, since we're I don't have time anymore. I will leave the discussion to the discussion session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we can go into the discussion session. We're running a little bit later than we thought, but we do have some time for some questions. I'm sure, Peter, you can help me organize that. I believe the way it's done is if you want to speak, then either notice so using the chat line or using the hand symbol in the chat.
Okay, I'll jump in here. First of all, if you're not already in the chat room, please join us in the chat room. The link to it is at the top of the session page. And if you're already in the chat room and you have a remark or a question to ask, on the lower right-hand side, there's a hand button which toggles a raising of your hand and lowering of your hand. So please click on that button now. If you are planning to say something, because that way the chairs would cue people up and call upon them one after the other. When you're done discussing, then you can lower your hand and the chair could call on the next person. But before you say anything, please make sure you can be heard. So, I mean, say something first and ask the chair to make sure he can hear you before you start making your remarks. Also, since we didn't have time to for people to make self-introductions, so before you speak, at least make a like 5-second intro of who you are in your affiliation or something in that nature. So please click on the hand button. Even if you had typed questions into the chat room, which I didn't see a lot, do feel free to verbally address them for the sake of the participants and address them to specific panelists or the chairs or to other participants as well. Back to our co-chairs.
So I believe the person on top was first. So Pat Cassidy, please.
Yeah, that's Pat. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. For Simon Schneider, question. On interoperability, the notion of interoperability as a communication problem and the various details he puts in there make a lot of sense. One thing, though, is what I don't see is, for example, references to the old notion of meaning as being procedural, or semantics as being procedural, that is to say, the meaning of an action, as a person understands the meaning of an action, is to be able to recognize the action when it's done or to do it oneself. The meaning of a picturable object is to be able to recognize the object when one sees it. And what this does is it relates meaning or semantics to procedures in the brain, if you will, or in the computer, but that depend upon perception. And so I don't see any references to procedural semantics in here, and I'm not clear, and in fact, I don't see any references to procedures at all, which is, I guess, what I'm concerned with. The question I had for Todd is this. Do you envision, as part of interoperability when it's genuinely mature, do you envision semantics as requiring some kind of robotic capability for perception and action so that these things can be encoded in machines in a standardized way? And I'm concerned with accurate interoperability and without perceptions and actions being encoded into machines so that you can compare them from one machine to another, I don't think it's possible. So, Todd, what's your thought? Or Simon, what's your thoughts on that?
Thank you very much. That's a good question. I mean, when I talked in my presentation about perceptual, technical, and constructive operation, I basically meant that actually. So I meant, I included here human level operations as well as technical or robotic actuators or something like that. I'm here not focusing on only the human side. Purposefully this is held in a very general manner here. So, and concerning your question about procedural semantics, that may be included here. Actually, I'm not sure whether it is the same. I only mean with this procedural semantics, but it may be included there, I would say. Yeah. So the traditional notion of procedural semantics in computer science, right?
Yeah, I guess on one of your slides where it mentioned semantic imitation tools, I think there is a procedure, instantiation simulation procedure, and then there's other learning procedures, but these seem to refer to logical operations. Are these procedures that you mentioned here, or either of those procedures, perhaps the learning procedure, does that include the possibility of a machine using perceptual tools to learn?
Yes, definitely. I mean,
okay.
I would say that these primitives, they are the slots, so to say. They may very explicit, and I gave an example. They may be measurements or observations or sensors, right?
Yes.
Or output of sensors, right?
Yes. And those have to be standardized too, otherwise they can't be compared.
Right, yeah. Yes, that's true, but, you know, the point is that if you have, let's say, if you have an established measurement scale, then, of course, there are other procedures implicitly underlying this, which are also standardized, right? So, of course, these primitives here are not primitive in an absolute sense or something like that, right? But the point is that I would like to make here is that if you go to slide 7, you know, this grounding level there is not fixed. So where you start constructing and where you end up is not fixed. And it doesn't have to be because it's a matter of agreement between provider and user. Right. So there's no a priori starting point to construct things. But the important message here is that, you know, we in communicating or in playing these imitation games, we have to specify which constructive calculi we use, where we start, so the primitive concepts and stuff like that. And that's at the moment, this is not being done. Or at least I don't see it, at least not in the ontology, engineering, and semantic web community. So I think that's necessary, yeah.
I guess if you've paid attention to ontology, you'll probably know that my main concern has been the construction of a foundation ontology that will be capable of specifying all concepts, and that can be used for interoperability, but that in order to be manageable, you'd probably want to focus on the primitive concepts for that. But the primitive concepts do include, you know, at some point they must have some reference to perception. For the time being, at the current time, of course, what we use as placeholders are elaborate descriptions of what we're talking about when we're doing our documentation.
Yeah, right.
People can each understand what this concept is supposed to mean. Ultimately, the machines must be able to do it themselves. But right now, we have to do it that way.
One comment to this. I just mentioned my thesis. It's called Grounding Geographic Information in Perceptual Operations.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't read the thesis. I guess I'm going to have to if I can get a copy of it.
Well, that's the basic idea here. So it's actually perceptual operations aren't necessarily involved there. It's not they're not the only ones, but they are necessarily involved, I would say.
Okay.
But there are other ones. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Edwin? Speaker Q shows Edwin Morris. Still here?
You have to do a *7, Edwin.
Yay. Edwin Morris here.
Here we know.
Hello.
We hear you.
Thank you. I am a student at the graduate course in Kent State University, Information Architecture and Knowledge Management. Question or observation I have is it seems as a novice to this ontological mentality of deciphering and disambiguating language and semantics relationships. It seems to me, in my short view of things, is that it's almost tail wagging the dog. And especially in this slide that's up right now, is that the function of interpretation is based on understanding the semantic relationships in kind of a one-way system. But in this image that's up right now, the thing that reminds me of that is the telegraph system. Dots and dashes were translated into alphabet and then translated into words, and then the understanding was upon the receiver to understand what the word was that was sent. To me, and I typed it in the box, I would think that in the builder of the information, in the producer of the information, the onus is upon them to create metadata that is corresponding to a deeper sense of meaning. So the disambiguation happens in an automated fashion. And it appears to me that a lot of time and effort is spent in the middle ground, trying to bridge the receiver and the producer of the information. I just wanted to open that up to dialogue and hear opinions and thoughts.
Perhaps just if I can say one sentence to that and then give it to the taking my prerogative as session chair. I completely sympathize with your perspective, Edwin. I just think that one of the key ideas, I would say, of the semantic web endeavor is to try to realize interoperability to a certain extent without solving the general AI problem. So one of the key issues from my perspective is finding exactly this middle ground where we try to advance without solving the big issues as well. Some of the others might have other opinions here. So who wants to talk?
Can I ask something, actually, because I don't have access to this VNC. Did you mean slide 7 in my presentation? the slide that you were talking about, right?
I believe okay. So.
Yeah, okay. And you mean this telegraph-like picture there. Well, maybe that's not a good picture. Essentially, this kind of semantic imitation game should not be understood as a simple, in an information science encoding decoding problem or something like that. That's not the case, and that's actually what is indicated, so to say, by the bottom of this image, where because these people have to do something, right, actively. They are not just receivers of symbols or information there. They have to, they actively have to do something. And I would say that that view, from in my perspective, at least, comes close to what we actually do when we try to understand each other. I mean, in a normal conversation, right? What we do is we try to approximate the other standpoint, right? And that we are doing by reconstruction, and that's an active thing that needs to be done, and that's maybe a big difference to the old paradigms, where the user and the provider are just maybe more passive, also. I don't know.
Well, I like what you're saying, and I understand. My perspective is that this is opening up a feedback loop. The user can ask in this relationship for definition and open up a line of verbal and nonverbal communication if they're actually face to face. That's missing in all the machine language. Email, a classic example. What I sent is not what I meant, type of thing. So how do you disambiguate the written language or just the semantic materials in order to make proficient machine interpretation?
Well, that's a big question. I have no idea, actually. The point is that we need... Yeah, you're right. That's a good idea. I mean, we need at least a feedback channel that we currently don't have. That's one thing. But we also need these tools that help the user to indicate, or the provider to indicate what they mean. So really what we need is tools that support these speech acts in semantics, okay, in semantic engineering. And we've not yet thought about this enough.
Well,
so maybe we have tools to do this, but...
To me, the bigger picture is in the gold is in the lining of trying to go after the provider, the builder of the information on the origination side, in order to add a schema of depth of understanding that facilitates automated connections. And I is there anyone out there doing that type of work now?
I don't think I'm not sure. I don't know. I only started thinking about that. So.
Okay. Maybe. Well, that was all I wanted to bring up, was that perspective. Thank you.
Okay.
Could
very
probably
important.
Say some more, but Peter, you have your hand up. So.
Right. I actually want to address Edwin's issue. Maybe the picture with two people at each end of the transaction threw us out. In particular, I mean, the major problems being addressed is that one needs to do knowledge representation so that the interpreter or the consumer of that knowledge is a machine and not another human being making another interpretation. So it's not interpretation, but rather how does one make the information or the knowledge computable?
Yes.
So it's a whole new can of worms that's being opened up. And that's exactly what ontologists have been doing, or people working on knowledge representation have been doing for decades, and ontolog have been doing, or ontolog community members have been doing for more the last 10 years or more. So stay tuned and look at some of the other contributions. So.
Pete, may I respond to this? I know that the first time you look at it, this seems to contradict the traditional view of ontology engineering. But I would say that it's not necessarily contradicting, because you can also view ontology engineering as an effort to actually realize kind of communication between users of data and providers of data. And right, because and in this case, ontologies are just a means to do this, right? And then you are back again into this picture. I would say that's not a contradiction necessarily. Yeah. Okay, that's.
Well, I wasn't saying it was a contradiction. I was just referring to the picture showing two humans and not showing, let's say, a machine in the mix. That
yep.
kind of yeah.
Yep.
Thinking that that
purposefully yeah. by that, that's by purpose actually because I want to concentrate on an aspect which is neglected by current views on the matter. I would say.
Thank you.
So actually the next thanks a lot. The next person was actually Gary. You put in a text. You want to phrase it verbally as well.
Okay. Put it into text so that it's part of the record, easily scannable. But I was wondering, between Ben and Pratit's discussions, presentations, whether there was some commonality or mutuality. So I was wondering if, for example, Ben sees the work he's reported on similarity as being able to address or support some of the ontology matching that Pratit discussed, all of which is intended to support the heterogeneity problem, right?
That, you know, so the work discussing in the structure, essentially, of the ontology and the way concepts are defined in the ontology to determine similarity, but you could certainly use the similarity results that I discussed as a way to inform sort of the kind of work that Pratik was talking about, of, you know, trying to infer sort of a more of a structure to these very flat knowledge representations, so in geonames and so on. I mean, I do think that there's definitely there's potential there to utilize those, and also I would say that the you know some of the notions that the work that I was talking about that had to do with, you know, asymmetry in terms of similarity and also context and all of these other things are all relevant to this other work on ontology alignment as well. I don't know if Deke has some thoughts on that as well.
Can you repeat the question? I actually missed a part of it.
I think Gary's question was just one. What way the similarity work that I discussed in terms of comparing the similarity of concepts within an ontology could address or support the ontology matching.
Can he elaborate a little bit more on that?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Gary?
I am not sure I'm able to elaborate much more on this, but I guess the question was because we had four speakers, and the topic was the recognizing heterogeneity of data and trying to support interoperability. I was trying to question whether some of the things that were discussed come together and whether indeed the presenters see some ways of leveraging each other's thoughts and approaches to support interoperability.
Definitely. I mean, some of the stuff which was definitely presented in the first slide, I can definitely see it being used, especially for finding some of the localized matches and all that. I'll have to look through the slides to identify more thoughts, but definitely at a surface level, I can definitely see some of the ideas coming together and helping with that.
Thanks. We actually, I believe we should probably come to a close at 3 p.m. That was the time frame we had originally. Now I see Todd on the speaker's queue and I see Scott on the speaker's queue. So perhaps we can manage to have a kind of quick question answer rounds. And in any case, we'll try to stop by 3 p.m. So Todd.
Thank you. I want to thank all the speakers. It was very interesting. But my response is to Edwin, the issue he raised, and I'm going to type the same information in the chat box, so I'll be quick. In terms of system interoperability and the semantic interoperability of systems, the NCOIC organization has attempted to start to address that problem in that many times people who develop systems do not recognize that they first need to somehow represent their context to end users from a system-to-system perspective. And then the other issue is that even if they have represented some part of that, there are implicit assumptions that people make.
Todd, we seem to be having some problems there. And I think that the question wasn't really phrased yet. So perhaps, Scott, you want to ask your question? We'll ask Todd when he comes back.
Okay, good. Thank you. Scott Hills with Chevron. And I guess I'd like to offer a tentative conclusion and get some reactions. And I'm going to take us back to Simon's now infamous slide 7. And I guess the line in there that made me start thinking about this is the task of the provider, third bullet. The task of the provider is to teach data categories with respect to grounding level by examples and rules. And that's, it's not difficult for me to recognize that that's the way I think most of us learn from someone that's teaching, and perhaps even by organizing and recognizing patterns in the world around us. But that's not what's going on when you're trying to mediate or recognize sort of semantic equivalence, if you will, or relationships between us, between concept terms and different ontologies. Because I think what happens is what the consumer sees is a sampling and processing of that information. Even if they get attributes and properties, they're still looking at a digested form of that information that may not match their reality and, or at least their perception of the same concepts. And I think Simon even has graphics that kind of support that. And so too does Janos in his introductory slide. When we saw the forest characteristics that used to define forests differed in terms of the attributes that were used. And so you can imagine that that's done when someone that actually calculates, or I should say derives the definition based on patterns they see, actually chooses those attributes which show the necessary variability and clustering to help differentiate, you know, subtypes, for example. And again, Simon had another slide where he was showing sort of the clusters, if you will, for mountains, and I don't remember what slide that was offhand, 10 or something like that, right. Clusters based on altitude and relative relief. Well, imagine that a consumer that has a different perspective actually has their own idea about clusters based on, let's say, the same attributes, but it turns out they're in a gap in the clusters that are represented. So how are you going to mediate between a producer and a consumer when the consumer actually has an idea about some feature, a mountain? I'll use mountain in this case because I don't have another one to put in a gap. But that doesn't correspond to the combination of attributes that the producer has ever seen before. So this kind of sort of digestion of information transfer, I think, that actually goes on and that probably in practical terms we're forced into. We can't hand over absolutely everything about the evidence we've used, or not the evidence, excuse me, the data to facilitate this translation. So how are we going to overcome this difference between the way it works in the real world and our constraints in working with ontologies and ontology translation?
Thank you very much. Can I say something to that? That's a very good point, I think, a very, very valid point also. My first reaction to that would be that this paradigm is not, you know, all these, for solving the merging problem or something like that, we have other paradigms, okay, other tools. I would say the purpose of this tool or of this approach is just not to come up with a least common subsumer or a compromise or something like that, but to highlight differences. And in order to highlight differences in the first place, right, this is a way to do this actually, right? Because you can then find out that in terms of, for example, certain measurement scales, your definition differs from the one of the user or the one of the provider. And then what I want to say is you know, there's a stage, or there's a phase of this whole process in which your goal is not to merge everything, but to emphasize heterogeneity in order to understand. And then once you have understood these differences, you can begin merging and comparing for similarity. So this is really, you know, in a stage which is before the merging and similarity stage, I would say, yeah. Because very often in the situation at the moment is that we don't know the difference, okay? We don't know, we can't differentiate these different perspectives. That's our main problem, I would say. Because we have very good merging tools, but not good tools to define or understand what the differences are. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. I think we're out of time. I'm not going to go further. Thanks, Janos.
Thanks, Simon. So I believe we're at 3 p.m. and I mean it's good to see that actually discussion is picking up, but we're actually running out of time. So I believe we can continue this offline or come back to one of these in another session. Thank you very much for joining. Feel free to contact the authors and the presenters if you have further questions or further points of discussion. And I believe I hand over to Peter for the final word.
Actually, Peter here. I really would like to thank the co-chairs for putting together this wonderful session, all the panelists with their rich and the content and sharing their insights and work with us. And of course, a big thank you to everyone who participated today. So as I mentioned on the chat, there are two more sessions coming up in this mini series. And if there's something specific that you would like to hear or gaps that should be filled in, please type that into the chat. Some of the co-chairs in the upcoming sessions are in the session today. They are reading this, and that would help them with putting in the right content that the community is looking for. And thanks, everyone. Great session. Bye-bye. Join us on November 1. For session 4 of this series. And by the way, we will be back to starting at 9:30 Pacific, 12:30 Eastern, and whatever other time zones, which would be the normal hours in that session. Thanks again. Bye-bye, everyone.